When you look at a blueprint for a skyscraper, there's this absolute expectation of obedience.
Right.
Like you draw a steel beam of a certain length, and the steel beam is fabricated to that exact length. The architecture dictates the materials. The macro world just, complies.
It does. I mean, you tell a ton of steel where to go, and it generally goes there without a fight.
But then you zoom in. You zoom way, way down to the nanoscale into the actual atomic structure of that very same steel beam. And suddenly that compliance completely
Yeah,
vanishes.
the blueprint doesn't dictate the materials anymore.
Exactly. The materials fight back. It's an absolute microscopic turf war down there. And today we're taking you on a custom deep dive directly into the center of that battlefield.
We really have a fascinating stack of source material on the table today, too. We're pulling heavily from some pretty dense metallurgical texts, specifically excerpts from Molybdenum Carbide in Tempered Martensite by Yamasaki and Bagetia, alongside some detailed sections from the book Theory of Transformations in Steels.
And we should establish right up front for you listening, the material we're diving into is dense.
Oh, very.
We are talking pages of complex coordinate transformation matrices, intense crystallography, atomic eigenvalues. But our mission today is to cut through all that raw math.
Right, to find the hidden architectural rules of metallurgy.
Exactly. We want to show you how the precise atomic level geometries of specific elements literally fighting for space, how they dictate the macro properties of the advanced materials that, hold our entire world together.
And my goal today is to translate those dense coordinate matrices into the physical why. Like, why do atoms arrange themselves into these highly specific configurations? How do they physically deform their environments? And why is this microscopic geometry matter to the physical objects you interact with every single day?
So let's jump right into the deep end, starting with how incredibly difficult it is to even accurately map this battlefield. The texts focus a lot on molybdenum carbide.
Right. Chemically, that's MOs2C. Two heavy molybdenum atoms for every one carbon atom.
And for a very long time, the scientific consensus fundamentally misunderstood the physical shape of this material, right?
They did. We had a massive blind spot, and it came down entirely to, well, the physics of our observation tools.
Okay, how so?
So early scientists, specifically Westgren and Fragman, they relied on X-ray diffraction to analyze the atomic structure of Mo2C. Now, X-ray diffraction works by bouncing X-rays off the electron clouds surrounding an atom's nucleus.
Okay, so it needs a big electron cloud to bounce off of.
Exactly. And molybdenum is a heavy transition metal. It has 42 electrons, so it acts like a giant, highly reflective dish for X-rays. It scatters them beautifully.
But carbon only has 6 electrons.
Right. Carbon's X-ray scattering power is just negligible in comparison. So when Westgren and Fragman looked at the X-ray diffraction patterns, they saw this brilliant, clear arrangement of the heavy molybdenum atoms.
And those were sitting in a hexagonal close-packed structure, right?
Exactly. But the carbon was essentially invisible to the instrument. They couldn't see it, so they just made a mathematical assumption about where it was sitting between the middle atoms.
It's like taking a photo of a crowded room with a camera flash that only reflects off people wearing blue shirts.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Right. You see the blue shirts perfectly arranged in the room, but you have absolutely no idea who else is sitting in the dark spaces between them. You assume the crowd is organized one way, completely missing half the picture.
That is a brilliant way to visualize the limitation, honestly. Because the true architecture remained hidden until the field adopted neutron diffraction.
Which is a totally different tool.
Completely different physical principle. Neutrons don't interact with electron clouds at all. They scatter directly off the atomic nucleus. And to a neutron, the scattering profiles of carbon and molybdenum are actually quite similar.
So the playing field was completely leveled.
Yes, the carbon was finally forced out of hiding, and the resulting data just, I mean, it overturned decades of assumptions.
Because the structure wasn't hexagonal at all.
Not at all. It is definitively orthorhombic. It belongs to the space group PBCN. And the carbon atoms weren't just randomly distributed in the gaps, you know. They were locked into highly rigid, mathematically specific coordinates.
The text calls those the 4C Wyckoff positions.
Right,
Right.
exactly.
Okay, but stop right there because I have to push back on this a bit.
Sure.
The text explicitly notes that between the old hexagonal theory and the new orthorhombic reality, the relative positions of the metal atoms, the molybdenum, they're essentially identical.
They are, yeah. The heavy metal framework didn't actually move.
So if the heavy lifting of the structure is still being done by the molybdenum, why do we care so much about the exact geometric coordinates of the carbon? I mean, it's just filling in the gaps, right?
You would think so, but treating carbon as mere filler really ignores how atomic structures interact with their surroundings.
How so?
Well, knowing the exact Wyckoff positions of the carbon atoms is critical because it fundamentally alters the external boundaries of the entire unit cell.
Oh, I see.
The true orthorhombic configuration gives us highly specific physical dimensions for the crystal's outer limits. The text gives the exact parameters, like A equals 0.4724 nanometers, B equals 0.6, and so on.
So knowing the carbon's exact location physically changes the footprint of the crystal itself.
Completely. And you have to remember that this O2C crystal isn't just floating in a vacuum. It exists inside a solid block of steel.
Right. A matrix of iron. Ferrite.
Exactly, ferrite. So knowing the true orthorhombic dimensions down to the 10,000th of a nanometer matters, because those precise dimensions dictate exactly how violently this carbide will clash with the surrounding ferrite matrix when it tries to grow.
Ah, okay. So X-rays lied to us about the carbon, but once we have the true shape, we can finally see how this material behaves under pressure.
Which is where things get really interesting.
Yeah, which brings us to the actual growth of this carbide inside the steel. And from what the source text reveals, it is an absolute atomic cage match.
The mathematics of this interface are staggering. The text uses these complex correspondence matrices to calculate the orientation relationship between the expanding O2C lattice and the rigid ferrite lattice surrounding it.
Right.
And the calculations prove that there's absolutely no invariant line between the two structures.
Wait, an invariant line meaning a physical plane where the two different crystal structures can meet perfectly without either side having to stretch or compress.
Exactly. An invariant line is basically atomic harmony.
Okay.
But here, there is no harmony. There's no angle or orientation where these two lattices align cleanly. The eigenvalues in the text quantify the physical deformation required to force these two materials together.
It's a lot, right?
It's massive.
Right.
If the carbide tries to grow along one particular axis, the math dictates it would have to physically stretch by over 28% to match the steel.
A 28% stretch. If you try to stretch a solid macroscopic piece of metal by a third of its length, it violently fractures. At the atomic level, the strain energy required to do that would just shatter the surrounding structure. It's impossible.
It is thermodynamically forbidden. The strain energy would be catastrophically high.
Wow.
However, the matrices also reveal a loophole.
Okay.
Along a different, highly specific trajectory, the 100 alpha direction, the required distortion drops drastically, down to less than 5%.
Oh, wow. So the carbide is trapped. It has to grow. But the steel matrix around it is acting like an incredibly rigid, unforgiving cage.
Right. It can't expand equally in all directions.
So it aggressively limits its own growth to that single forgiving axis.
It takes the only path of least resistance available to it. And the physical manifestation of this geometric compromise is really striking.
Yeah, the text includes these transmission electron microscope micrographs TEM imagery taken by Yamasaki. When you look at these images, the molybdenum carbide doesn't form neat little blocks or spheres. It forms incredibly long, impossibly thin needles that aggressively crisscross through the tempered martensite.
It really is a wild visual.
I love the visual of this. It's like, okay, it's like taking a giant, incredibly bulky sleeping bag and trying to force it into a tiny, rigid stuff sack.
That's a great analogy.
Right. The sack, the surrounding ferrite matrix, it completely refuses to yield. So it physically crushes the sleeping bag into a specific elongated shape. The neighborhood literally dictates the physical form of the occupant.
It does. And the text offers a brilliant piece of supporting evidence to prove that this needle shape is entirely unnatural. It's an architecture forced by the steel.
Because it asks what happens to Motici when you remove the straitjacket.
Exactly. What happens when it's allowed to grow completely unconstrained?
Right.
The researchers examine Motici synthesized purely for catalysis, or grown during the chemical vapor deposition of graphene on liquid copper.
Where there's no solid steel crushing it.
Right. In those environments, there is no rigid lattice crushing it from the outside. And the resulting shape is entirely different.
It doesn't form a single needle.
Nope.
It forms spheroids, or these beautiful, highly defined faceted plates. When the internal geometry is finally allowed to express itself freely, its natural state is flat and faceted.
Yeah.
The needle is nothing but a permanent record of its microscopic war with the steel.
It really is a stunning example of how macro properties are born from atomic scale compromises.
But you know, the Motosi needles aren't the only time our tools struggle to show us the true nature of these turf wars. We talked about X-rays missing carbon entirely, but even when we upgrade to powerful electron microscopes and look directly at the shape of these structures, the visuals can still deceive us.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, take the case of M7C3.
M7C3 is a fascinating contrast. It's a large, faceted primary carbide that is absolutely vital in hard-facing high-entropy alloys.
And just for context, these are the specialized, ultra-tough materials used in heavy industrial applications, right, where extreme wear resistance is required.
Exactly. And for decades, the scientific community suffered from a collective optical illusion regarding this specific carbide.
What were they seeing?
Well, when researchers looked at large M7C3 carbides under transmission electron microscopes, they saw these distinct microscopic streaks running completely through the structure.
Okay.
And the widespread assumption was that these streaks were simply stacking faults.
Which, in crystallographic terms, is essentially an insertion error during growth, right?
Right. Crystals build themselves by stacking planes of atoms in very precise repeating sequences. A stacking fault occurs when an extra atomic plane gets inserted incorrectly, disrupting the pattern.
Mm.
So it was assumed these highly stressed industrial carbides were just, you know, full of structural errors.
But the recent crystallographic studies cited in our text reveal that those streaks aren't errors at all. Like, they aren't flaws in the material. Far from it. Detailed diffraction analysis proved that the alloy indexes as a complex hexagonal structure with space group P63MMC.
Okay.
Those visible streaks are actually alternating bands of two completely distinct crystallographic variants of the carbide existing side by side in perfect registry.
And the scale of this is what really blows my mind. We are talking about alternating variants that are each only 5 to 10 nanometers thick.
It's tiny. It is a highly ordered, intricately layered composite structure at the absolute limit of physical measurement. What looked to the naked eye like a series of mistakes was actually an incredibly sophisticated atomic reinforcement mechanism.
The level of hidden organization is just staggering.
It really is.
But we spent this entire time talking about how materials negotiate their shape to survive within a specific environment. Let's look at the limits of that negotiation.
Okay. Yeah.
We saw how molybdenum and carbon aggressively deform themselves into needles to survive inside a ferrite matrix. What happens when you change the neighborhood? What happens when that matrix is austenite instead of ferrite? Oh, this touches on one of the most fundamental rules of phase transformations. Austenite is a completely different phase of iron.
Right.
It is a face-centered cubic crystal structure, meaning the internal geometries and interstitial spaces are completely different from ferrite. And the text reveals that at typical steel compositions, Motosi is fundamentally unstable in a pure austenite matrix.
Wait, completely unstable. So the exact same raw elements that fought tooth and nail to form intricate needles in one type of iron structure just absolutely refuse to mingle in another.
They won't do it. The thermodynamic conditions simply do not allow it.
Wow.
Yeah, the researchers utilized atom probe tomography, which is a technique that can literally reconstruct a material atom by atom in three dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And the atom probe data shows absolutely zero detectable clustering of molybdenum and carbon in the austenite phase. They don't even attempt to form a precursor to a carbide.
It is a total rejection. The host matrix isn't hospitable, so the chemistry physically cannot happen.
Exactly. The neighborhood dictates everything.
Which, honestly, perfectly sets up the final and definitely the most chaotic segment of our deep dive today.
Oh, yeah.
If the atomic framework dictates the chemistry so rigidly, what happens when human engineers try to forcefully rewrite that framework?
The alchemist's dilemma. This brings us to the complex physics of low-density steels.
Right. Right now, every major industry, I mean, automotive, aerospace, shipping, they're all desperate for lighter structural materials to increase efficiency and, you know, reduce fuel consumption.
Absolutely.
And our source text dives deep into these early Russian efforts to engineer low-density steels, attempting to drop the overall density of the metal down to about 6.8 grams per cubic centimeter.
And conceptually, the simplest way to reduce the density of an iron lattice is to forcefully substitute lighter atoms into the structure.
Makes sense.
Right. The element of choice here is aluminum. The baseline recipe they developed was an alloy consisting of iron, 25% manganese, 10% aluminum, and 1% carbon by weight.
And adding the aluminum successfully drops the weight, right? And it provides fantastic oxidation resistance. It sounds like a massive engineering win.
On paper, yes. But there is a very severe consequence to forcing aluminum into an iron lattice.
What happens?
It aggressively destabilizes the austenite phase we were just talking about.
Oh, no.
Yeah. If the aluminum concentration gets too high, the austenite phase field vanishes completely from the thermodynamic system. And if you lose austenite, you lose the ability to control the microstructure of the steel through heat treatments.
So the material becomes utterly useless for high-level engineering.
Completely useless.
So engineering basically becomes an exercise in damage control. To artificially keep the austenite phase on life support, you have to pump in large concentrations of manganese and carbon.
Right, because those act as austenite stabilizers. But this is where the law of unintended consequences takes over.
Always does.
By creating this highly specific, highly crowded elemental cocktail of iron, manganese, aluminum, and carbon, you inadvertently trigger the thermodynamic formation of a completely new, incredibly problematic phase.
The mutant offspring of the alloy.
Yes.
Kappa carbide, or kappa carbide, depending on how you say it.
Kappa carbide is the absolute bane of low-density steel engineering. Its formation almost uniformly degrades the mechanical properties of the steel, making it unacceptably brittle.
Yikes.
And the text points out a fascinating quirk about its structure. Despite the name, it isn't even a strict carbide in the traditional crystallographic sense.
Right, because a traditional carbide generally has a rigid, repeating stoichiometric formula.
Exactly.
But kappa carbide, which forms in a primitive cubic structure under space group PM3M, is actually a solid solution. Its chemical formula is completely variable. It's Fe4YaSx.
That variable formula tells a story of intense atomic displacement. In this structure, the aluminum atoms are literally stealing the seats of the iron atoms within the crystal lattice. And when an aluminum atom forces its way into an iron position, it doesn't just change the weight, it physically warps the surrounding geometry.
And that warping directly impacts the carbon.
Right. Carbon is a tiny element. It doesn't take up a primary seat in the lattice. It hides in the small, empty voids between the larger metal atoms.
Mm-hmm.
These specific voids are called octahedral interstices. Aluminum atoms are fundamentally different in size and electron configuration than iron. So when an aluminum atom occupies a lattice site, it physically distorts the shape of that adjacent octahedral interstice.
It's essentially a spatial eviction.
It is.
It's like taking a parking lot designed for compact cars and suddenly parking massive heavy-duty trucks in every other space.
That is exactly what it's like.
The total volume of the lot might be the same, but the geometric gap between the vehicles has physically shrunk. The bicycles, the tiny carbon atoms that used to comfortably fit in the margins are physically squeezed out of the lot.
That is precisely what happens. The altered interstice becomes physically and thermodynamically hostile to the carbon atom. The aluminum literally squeezes the carbon out, drastically altering its local concentration.
Right.
And because the formula is variable, the lattice parameter, the actual physical dimensions of the unit cell, it fluctuates wildly depending on the precise atomic percentages of the aluminum, the carbon, and the manganese at any given coordinate.
It basically breathes and shifts based on the exact local recipe.
Yeah.
You try to solve a macro problem making a vehicle lighter by injecting aluminum, and you inadvertently spawn a shape-shifting mutant solid solution that evicts carbon and shatters the ductility of your metal.
It proved you cannot treat these alloys as simple mixtures. Every single elemental addition fundamentally rewires the structural logic of the entire system.
It is an incredibly delicate, highly reactive web of constraints.
It really is.
Which brings us to the culmination of our deep dive today. Let's trace the arc of what we've unpacked for you. We started by exploring how our early observation tools were blind to the lighter elements.
Right, leading us to mistake an orthorhombic reality for a hexagonal illusion. Simply because we couldn't see the carbon atoms defining the boundaries.
And then we witnessed how the rigidly unyielding steel matrix physically crushes those molybdenum carbides, forcing them to abandon their natural faceted shape and grow as microscopic needles just to survive the massive strain energies.
We looked at how M7C3 carbides utilize incredibly complex 5-nanometer alternating crystallographic variants to reinforce themselves.
Completely tricking our microscopes into seeing stacking faults.
Mm-hmm. And how changing the neighborhood to austenite causes a complete rejection of molybdenum and carbon clustering entirely.
And finally, we saw the chaotic limits of human engineering in low-density steels, where forcing aluminum into the lattice violently shrinks the octahedral interstices,
spawning the carbon-evicting, highly unpredictable kappa carbide.
So why does understanding this microscopic turf war matter to you?
It matters because every macro-level physical property of the built environment around you, I mean, the fuel efficiency of the plane you fly in, the safety of the car frame protecting you, the sheer durability of the industrial machinery maintaining your city's infrastructure, none of these are simple top-down engineering victories.
No, they're really not.
They are all fundamentally the byproduct of highly sensitive, nanoscale geometric compromises. The atoms are negotiating every fraction of a nanometer, and the physical world is just the aggregate result of who won those negotiations.
The blueprint is ultimately written by the survivors of that atomic cage match.
It really is. But I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, looking toward the absolute cutting edge of where this science could take us.
Okay, lay it on us.
We spent a lot of time today talking about how brutal the physical constraints of metallurgy are. But remember earlier, we learned that unconstrained molybdenum carbide naturally forms these beautiful faceted platelets.
Right, like when it's used for the chemical vapor deposition of graphene.
Exactly. So if the steel matrix acts as a straitjacket, forcing the carbide into needles, could we theoretically engineer entirely new artificial metal matrices?
Wait, like custom straitjackets?
Precisely. Not to make better steel for cars or bridges, but simply to serve as atomic molds. We could intentionally force carbides into exotic, totally unprecedented shapes.
Oh, wow. So we use the turf war to our advantage.
Exactly. We can shape entirely new nanostructures for next-generation chemical catalysis or even quantum technologies just by designing the perfect restrictive atomic neighborhood.
Engineering the mold instead of the material. That fundamentally changes how we think about the physical future. Definitely something for you to mull over the next time you look at the engineered world around you. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.